Good day, everyone. This is Brenda speaking. Welcome to the IRP IoT call on the 17th of November, 2020 at 1700 UTC. This meeting is recorded. Kindly state your name when speaking for the record and keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking. Attendance will be taken via Zoom. I will note that Christina has sent apologies and I'm turning the meeting over to Susan. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Brenda. Thanks to everyone for those of you who've been able to join. I've just had a sort of last minute sort of semi apologies from Kurt, who is caught up on another meeting, but will join us shortly. So hopefully we'll have him too. But I think we have we've got a reasonable turnout. I think we probably have enough to view ourselves as quorate. So let's kick off. This is our meeting of the 17th of November. First off, just the usual review of the agenda and updates to SOI. So I'll just start with that. Does anyone have any SOI updates that they want to flag? Oh, thanks, Ben. Okay, I'm not hearing anything. And I'm just noting in the chat that Becky's also sent some apologies. Okay, so reviewing the agenda then, we'll look back to the action items from the last meeting. There'll be a quick update from the subgroup that's been looking at the consolidation intervention and participation as an amicus section and trying to take that forward. And then we'll continue our discussion on the time for filing, followed by AOB, if anyone has any that they want to raise. If you have any that you know of now, then please feel free to flag it now, either by putting your hand up or putting it in the chat. Otherwise, I'll ask again when we get to the end of the call. And our next meeting, just to note, is going to be on the 1st of December. This year has gone very fast in our 1900 UTC slot. So circling back to agenda item two, the action items, the first one we had was an item for staff. We talked about having a scorecard that would enable us to track our progress against the major items we need to tick off. So I think, Ben, I'm not sure if there's an update on this one for now, but we may just keep it on the agenda for noting.
Yeah, I haven't gotten around to that one. I should have it done for our next meeting.
Super. Thank you. Yeah, we'll just keep it on the radar. The second agenda item was for Malcolm got a particular name check, but it was also for anyone else as well who had examples of issues that we could use as to essentially to try to kind of stress test the discussions that we've been having on the timing issue. And with thanks to Malcolm for circulating earlier today, a couple of examples that we'll come back to in a few minutes when we get onto the timing issue. It may well be that there might be some others that people want to raise during the call, or it may be that this stays on as a kind of an item for us all to think about in the next, after this call and before the next one as well. So item three is just a quick update on the consolidation subgroup meeting. The subgroup met last week for our first meeting, and I would say we had it turned out to be a fairly productive call. I think it was quite helpful. So on the subgroup, on the call at least, we had it was myself and Helen. I'm going to say Scott. I'm already forgetting who else was on there. Liz was on there. Sam unfortunately was unable to make it, as was Christina. I think we Flip, I think, also was unable to make it, but is one of our small group members. So we were a fairly small group, and apologies if I've forgotten anyone. But we did sort of kick off with a discussion and just did make, I think, some reasonable progress on the sort of notion of the procedures officer. And I think where we're probably coming down to is to favour more of a kind of emergency panelist type concept who could consider any of the issues that come up as a sort of pre-issue before there's a panel in place. So the main issues would probably be at the moment, sort of if there were any application for emergency relief, any of these kind of consolidation type applications, and indeed any applications for translation assistance. So I think we as we talked round, you know, it may be that would then require that would be that enough of a change that it might need an additional public comment period. But I think on one of our very early calls of this reconstituted group, we felt that the likelihood was that any rules that we did come up, any amendments to the temporary rules that we did come up with would probably need to go out for public comment anyway. And so certainly I don't think that would be a reason not to do something if it does seem to us to make sense. And then we also started to have a discussion on which panel takes priority, where there is a panel in place, or whether we've got the rule right for how you choose panelists if cases have been consolidated where you've now got more parties involved and who should be responsible for picking the panelists and so on. So we've definitely got more to do. But we, I think, as I said, we made some sort of good, you know, a good start on our first call. We have our next call next Tuesday. We're going to try and alternate with these calls unless we feel we need to meet more frequently than that, in which case we can obviously schedule additional subgroup calls. But for now, you know, our next call will be next Tuesday, and then we'll be able to give another update on the next IoT call. And hopefully we won't need to have too many calls before we've sort of feel like we've made a sort of decent stab at coming up with a proposed new version of that rule that we can circulate to the wider group. I'll just pause and see if any of the small group members want to add anything to that.
Yeah, Susan, this is Scott Austin for the record.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
Yeah, just when we were in the group, and I haven't been able to pull it back up, there was a link that was given to a particular, I don't know if it was a transcript of the proceeding or it was some written material that tracked, I think it may have been a report by the panelists, and because we were having some difficulty trying to determine if the term emergency panelist or the alternate term that we've been having some trouble with, the procedures officer, was really the best choice for that role. And as I looked at that transcript, it was clear that the function was an emergency panelist. And I think that was really the term. And I think that's one of the things that we talked about, that we have some idea, some understanding from arbitration rules of what an emergency panelist is and their roles and their limits and their function. But I think that there's still some question about what a procedural officer is. So I think that it bolstered my support for the idea of, you know, relying on emergency panelist as the term, or at least certainly tying that to a definition or tying that to the function and role. Just a note.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Scott. And I think that really is that is sort of where we were coming out on the call was a feeling that you know, we know from past experience that the procedures officer role has been causing some difficulties, and so you know, looking at it in the light of what happens in other sort of arbitral rules and so on, might help to alleviate that confusion, if you like. And so I think, as I say, I think that's where we're coming out. Certainly I wouldn't say that that's a definite decision yet, but just really as an update to the group. But we'll keep meeting in our small group, and we'll report back and hopefully have a draft rule for the wider group to review in the near future. Okay. Welcome, Christina. I just seen that you, we had apologies for you, but it looks as though you're able to join us after all. So that's great. Okay, so we are on agenda item 4, which is to continue the discussion on the time for filing. And so just as a kind of really quick recap on what we discussed on our call last week, I would say we in advance of the call we'd had some emails just in the run up to the last meeting where we'd sort of identified or established that we're talking about two different time limits. So if one likes, there's the first prong or the first time limit is the time at which the a particular claimant can bring their claim once they are aware or reasonably to have become aware of the relevant action or inaction. We didn't really spend that much time talking about that last week. It's certainly something we will need to circle back to. It's an area where there've been two public comments, and as a result of the initial public comment, the time limit for claimants to bring such a claim was extended to allow a sort of much longer period of time, and then that was put out for public comment, and I would say there was a fair bit of support for that change during that second public comment period. But we do, as a group, we will need to sort of circle back to that and take a view on whether that's now sort of set the right balance, if you like. But what we did spend our time talking about was the other time limit, or the prong two, which is whether there should be, notwithstanding that prong one, whether there should be some overall cutoff or repose period after which it's not possible to bring a claim, so that if, for example, a claimant hadn't become aware and hadn't reasonably ought not reasonably to have become aware within a certain period of time, whether nonetheless they might be barred from bringing an action because they'd because the time, be that 12 months or whatever period, had expired. So we spent our time mostly talking about that, and I would say, I think we'd all agree that's the more challenging aspect of the timing rule, and the one that has the sort of the very strong opinions, sort of somewhat diametrically opposed, if you like. So there are certainly a number of the participants in this group who feel very strongly that the notion of the repose is contrary to the bylaws and to the expectations that came out of the accountability work that developed those new bylaws. In our bylaws, there is talk of the time for filing rule specifically addressing the time for filing once the claimant becomes aware or should reasonably have become aware of the action or inaction giving rise to the dispute. And there's also that since the notion of who is an eligible claimant is basically predicated on them having become materially affected by the action or inaction in question, it's certainly possible that a repose has the potential to put a claimant out of time for bringing a claim before they ever became eligible to bring their claim because they simply didn't qualify as a claimant within that sort of time period. And so that's certainly one perspective from a number of the participants in this group, including Malcolm, and not wanting to put sort of words into their head, but I would say Greg was probably also arguing very strongly to that effect. On the other perspective, there are concerns from a number of participants, again, that that concept of having any board action or indeed staff action challenged forever puts the board in an untenable position of having their actions potentially found to be improper years after the decision was made and years after they and the, you know, others in the community have been, you know, acting on those decisions. You know, and indeed what would be the impact if those for those who've been acting in reliance on something as being sort of a valid decision of the board, if it's then set aside, you know, years after the event. Now, I think I would say I think we certainly didn't come to sort of a kind of meeting of the minds during last week's call, but there was some discussion and Malcolm raised an interesting point that he thought it was possible that perhaps we were talking at cross purposes to some extent, and that perhaps there are different types of decision and maybe they need to be treated differently. And so, for example, if there's an action that's from the board that was clearly ultra vires, and so just simply ought never to have been made, then you know, because it's sort of exceeding the ICANN mission, for example, then that sort of, you know, challenging of that kind of ultra vires decision should not be time limited in this way. But perhaps there are other decisions that maybe you know, might still be in breach of the bylaws and therefore would be qualifying as an IRP, but don't necessarily sort of rise to the level of being completely ultra vires. And I think that's sort of where we came to and something that we perhaps could usefully explore further. And with that in mind, Malcolm, as I mentioned, sort of responded to the request that he come up with some examples that we could consider as a group that might help us to understand that position and where he's coming from better. And so I don't know to what extent they were circulated relatively recently. And so I'm not sure that people necessarily will all have had a chance to review them. I think we've got Malcolm on the call. And I'm wondering, Malcolm, if you are with us, would you like to start us off by kind of talking us through the two examples and then we can take it from there?
Yes, thank you, Susan. Malcolm Hartley for the record. Thank you. Yes, well, I put together these two examples at your request. I was rather hoping actually that there'd be some scenarios in the other side to show what problems were anticipated if there was no repose. But I haven't seen any of those. I don't know if you've received them direct any further examples directly from anyone else, Susan.
No, I'm afraid I haven't, okay. Which is why I think it may be something that we need. We may come up with some on the call as we're discussing this, but it might be something that we need to kind of look to people to do, you know, following this call.
Okay. Well, I think that would be helpful. I mean, I'm not going to read out the full text of these, but... because it's rather long and it will take up too much time on the call. But essentially what I've produced here are scenarios that create the structure of a realistic case, even though the specifics and the facts involved are fictitious, some might say fanciful, indeed in some of the minor specifics, I actually had a little bit of fun. But nonetheless, it raises a serious point. And I took two scenarios, one where the essence, the gravamen of the complaint is that ICANN has a program that it is operating, and that whole program is ultra vires outside the scope of the mission. And the second scenario was one where ICANN had developed a policy, and that policy is being applied. And while it was possible to challenge the application of that policy to a particular case, the person who was subject to it said, no, I'm not even going to get into the details of the application of this policy to my case. merely having a policy of that nature is ultra vires and explicitly prohibited by Article 11C, the one that says that ICANN shall not seek to regulate the use of the DNS. So they were the two broad scenarios there. And essentially, I'll give you the summary of each. The first one was one where ICANN creates a program. Actually, it's essentially modeled on something like the auction proceeds thing, where ICANN decides to spend a large amount of money that it's come into as a windfall on some good works. And it happens to select training in developing countries. And it provides this on a free of charge basis and runs into conflict with a local training provider who sees it as unfair competition and is going to drive them out of business. And they seek to argue that ICANN should never be in the business of providing training services. It's completely outside ICANN's role. And when they raise this with ICANN, ICANN is unpersuaded, says that it wishes to carry on. So they seek to bring an IRP case, and they are challenged on their right as to whether this claimant is challenged on their right as to whether they can bring this IRP case. ICANN says that you can bring an IRP case as to how we've run this program in your country. And since we only decided this year to even provide this program in your country, you could actually even bring a case challenging our decision to select your country. But the whole program that we've been doing for now 5 years now of running training programs using essentially auction proceeds, that's out of time. You can't challenge that now. And the training company, the private commercial company, says, no, I was only materially affected by this plan when you came into my country and started competing with me. And I've brought my challenge immediately upon that happening. I didn't know anything. I'd never heard of ICANN before. I acted promptly as soon as you started competing with me. I want to bring my case. I am acting in a timely fashion. I've acted within 120 days of being affected and of having a right to bring a case. I would like the declaration. Now, I know that the IRP has limited relief and all the rest of it, but nonetheless, it promises the possibility of a declaration that this program is out of scope, beyond the scope of ICAM's limited mission. And I ask the IRP to hear my argument as to why they should give me that declaration. And in the second case, we've got essentially a scenario that posits the extension of something like the UDRP into a whole new area. And the example here we've got is health. And it's an example of a policy being adopted to say that it's abusive use of the DNS to promote dangerous things which are medically dangerous. And then somebody, some agency has taken that and is using that to seek to apply their national regulations on the labeling of food. A company that is engaged in, that provides a baker's basically, that provides high fat, high calorie baked goods and is failing to comply with a particular country's regulations on disclosure of the dangers of obesity and all the rest of it. Is basically challenged by a national health authority saying, ICANN, you've got this policy on abusive use of the DNS. This is abusive use of the DNS. It's very bad for people's health. Take this DNA, this domain away from them. The UDRP judge happens to rule for the public authority, and the bakers has the option under the UDRP of appealing that decision, but the bakers decides not to take that option. They decide not to challenge the application of that policy to them, but instead to say that merely having a policy like that, of any kind like that, is specifically prohibited under the bylaws, under Article 1, Section 1.1C, that says that ICANN cannot use the DNS to seek to regulate the content of services that that use the DNS. And that's therefore they want the IRP to declare that this whole policy is invalid, and therefore the UDRP case falls away completely. And ICANN argues that you can appeal this case under the UDRP, or you could even do an IRP case challenge how the policy has been applied to you, but you cannot challenge the policy itself. That was set many years ago. And the registrant says, no, as soon as the case was brought against me, I filed this IRP case. I'm filing it in time. So those are my scenarios. And I think they set out really the issue of, you know, what is at issue here in this debate. And they also show, I think, what will be lost if there is repose, because both of these cases speak to whether or not it is possible to challenge ICANN acting beyond the scope in an ongoing fashion based on a decision that was taken many, many years ago. So that really sets that out there. And I hope we can have I hope they're useful. I hope somebody found some humor in there as well. But I hope it sets out the essence of the position and shows how merely challenging things on an as applied basis is no substitute for being able to challenge it at root.
Lovely. Thank you, Malcolm. And I would say I did find them useful. Albeit the as you say, they're pretty fanciful, and one could, you know, one struggles to imagine that you would get to that point without, you know, without there having already been some challenge, probably in both of those cases. But you know, your point is well made. You know, we can't assume that would be the case, and so. I think thank you. You certainly have done what we were asking for, and that I found that very useful. Hopefully others did too. So I've got Christina's hand up, and then I might also turn to Sam, because I know she circulated a couple of quick comments by email literally just before the call started, and I confess I haven't read them. So I may try and put Sam on the spot, but Christina first. Not hearing you at the minute, Christina.
Oh, sorry.
There you are. I
can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. And I apologize in advance. We're having another fairly breezy day. And given how wooded our neighborhood is, the internet's been going in and out. So I'll be quick. Malcolm, I found these stress cases very, very useful. And something that I've been wondering about that may be able to help us a little bit, and this is really, I should know this, I think, but I don't. And I'm wondering, is there a time limit anywhere that sets the deadline by which a ICANN consensus policy that has, you know, gone through the GNSO PDP process, been approved by the board, is there a deadline by which that must be implemented? Because to the extent that there is, or to the extent that we can, there's any historical data that would allow us to figure out what that window is, that might allow us to set at least an outer boundary for any kind of repose period, because, you know, just picking up on the point that Malcolm was making in the UDRP stress test, you know, it seems that in some cases the policy will be itself be the issue, but in others it will be the implementation. Thanks.
Thanks, Christina. And I feel I should know that too, but I don't. Sam has her hand up, so she may be to answer that question, or it may be because I said I was going to call on her. But either way, Sam.
Thanks. So I'll first turn to Christina's question, and then we can see if you want me to go on about my note. But Christina, I don't believe, and we'll check with our policy team to confirm, but I don't believe that there's an outer limit on or a requirement of time between the approval of a policy and the implementation. I think we have many structures that are developed across the, you know, particularly in the GNSO scenario, because I know that there are other entities that make policy in ICANN, but with the GNSO for consensus policies, we have other structures such as the CPIF, where there's, you know, an implementation discussion that happens with the community. And so things, I think each policy on its own terms, some are far more more intricate to implement. So some move faster, some move slower, particularly depending on the amount of discussion that has to happen with an IRT. That's the implementation review team from the community that supports ICANN in the implementation work. So I'll confirm with our policy colleagues, but I don't believe that we have any sort of outer limit. But I do want to confirm for those who weren't part of our earlier conversations on the IoT that from the ICANN side, we see every individual act, and the bylaws now stretch to both the board and the org. So every individual act of the ICANN board or the ICANN org can in and of itself be the subject that triggers an IRP. And so in a situation where we have an issue with implementation, even if that issue goes back to the more fundamental issues of the policy itself, but you know, if ICANN initiates the implementation and puts something into practice on a policy, if there's an ICANN act you can point to, that's what you can point to say that it's within the bylaw, that there's a potential bylaws violation that's given rise to an IRP. You don't necessarily have to trail everything back to the moment that the ICANN board accepted the policy recommendations, if that's helpful.
Thanks, Sam. So I've got a bit of a queue going now. And depending on what they raise, I might want to circle back on that as well when we look at it in context of Malcolm's examples. But let's go to David first. David, not hearing you either. I think it might be the dreaded double mute. No, I'm still not hearing you, David, but.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Thank you, I apologize.
But a little quiet.
Okay, so I apologize for the delay. Is that better?
Yeah, you're fine. You're a tiny bit distorted, but I think we'll be fine. So go for it, thank you.
You sound like you're down a well, David, but other than that, it's great.
Sorry, I've been up since midnight on another conference. And so anyway, I'll try and speak slowly and clearly. First of all, let me say that I have been tied up for a long time. I have not had a chance to read Malcolm's scenarios, but I will do that. And so I'd like to reserve some time to comment on them. But I would like to say that with respect to what Sam just said, I think that's right. I think the IRP sort of drawn up largely to be an as-applied accountability mechanism. And I think in the scenarios that Malcolm has, if I heard him correctly, or if I gathered correctly from what he said, I don't believe that IRP is a declaratory judgment kind of action. This is my personal thinking on this now, that's open to anybody in the world to challenge something without the showing of harm. I think that it's clear that in the definition of what a claimant is, that they have to show harm or injury from the action or inaction that took place. And with respect to remedy, there are remedies for these kinds of way off the track policies, including removal of board members if they go off the tracks, empowered community rejection actions if that would be called for along the way, empower community or even supporting organization, IRPs, et cetera. So while I haven't read the scenarios based on what Malcolm said, I think the IRP panel isn't a declaratory judgment panel. They do need to have a harm to say was within was occasioned by an action that was in the a violation of the bylaws of the articles. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Greg.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. And sorry I missed the first probably 25 minutes or so because I had a business call, which actually was supposed to last longer. So I've been giving this some thought. And excuse me if this is actually ground that was gone over before. And I just kind of was typing out a reply to an email that I had let too long from Chris to Spain. But in any case, the old IRP, was pretty clearly a tool aimed at challenging a decision on procedural grounds only. So it was the process by which that decision was reached that was challenged, which to some extent resulted in sort of a kabuki theater, because the challenge was always really about the substance of the policy. Because clearly you wouldn't challenge the process by which a policy was arrived at if you liked the policy. So it was an interesting setup and one that was deeply dissatisfying. I see the policy as it stands now, it's clearly aimed at challenging the substance as to whether it is within the scope of the bylaws or not. That's obviously a very simplistic version of whatever test might be applied, but it's a substantive question and not a procedural one. But then the question becomes, is this still about reviewing a decision, or is it about reviewing the underlying policy, the thing that was decided? Maybe this has something, this is kind of growing pains for the policy, and I'm not actually sure where this comes out logically, which I'll admit, if we're only focused on the decision, then the time at which the decision was made becomes is important, and it's kind of repose from decision making that is being sought. If what's being sought is to make a policy itself kind of incontestable after a period of time from all parties, even those who come along later and newly find that whatever it is they're trying to do is barred by a policy they believe violates the bylaws, what is their recourse if it's not the IRP? Obviously the R stands for review the last time I checked. So that kind of goes against the grain of where I think we ended up in substance, which is a tool for challenging policies or the implementation of those policies in ways that is outside the bylaws. And I think that speaks in many ways against repose, is that the criticism is not necessarily that the decision was wrongly administered in some fashion, but that the result stands as a continuing problem under the bylaws. So it's in a sense, it's a different posture. And if we think that the posture of this is still only a decision-making posture, then I think we kind of maybe missed the mark several years ago when we were looking at what was wrong with the accountability aspects of the IRP. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Sam?
Thanks, Greg. I'd like to piggyback off your point a bit, because I think that the way you framed that makes a lot of sense, right? So the IRP, as I understand it through the the changes that were made during the accountability process, it's not about solely about decisions, it's about acts. And so an act can be a decision, but an act can be something else. And so if the IRP is envisioned as something that you only allow review of the originating act, and we're setting up a time frame under which you get to the originating act, then I understand why we're having this conversation, right? Because then it seems like you're always out of luck unless you've acted within that very short time frame. And indeed, there might be circumstances within which you don't even know in that short time frame because of the discussion we've been having about implementation or something else. But that's actually not the case. That's not how we understand it within ICANN. That's not how we understand the intent of the bylaws, which don't limit itself to a decisional basis, but limit itself, but is really about acts of the ICANN board or the ICANN org, right? So we've created this big expansion that goes to places that is really about what has ICANN overtly or failed to do in certain situations that could give rise to a harm sufficient for someone to bring an IRP. And so I think that that's a really important concept to make sure that we're on the same page about, because if we see the IRP solely as the ability to challenge a decision, I think that we are severely limiting the reach of the IRP. And, you know, that is not how ICANN itself observes it. ICANN, you know, internally at org, we look at everything we do. Are we acting within mission? Are we doing this the way that we're supposed to be? And so, you know, that's how we expect to be tested. And we don't expect to be putting into place things that just can't be undone in the future. Because then you have to look at the practical impact of what an IRP says in an as-applied circumstance. So taking one of Malcolm's examples, you know, if the IRP, the panel comes back with a declaration in either of these situations that ICANN's, you know, implementing this program in, you know, the country that you created, or having this policy that as implemented goes to content that's against the bylaws, ICANN can't just turn around and say, oh, this is just about this one instance. It still has the impact of causing ICANN and the ICANN community to step back and look at the totality of what's been done. These have forward-looking impacts, right? So IRPs are binding. They have precedential effects. So ICANN couldn't keep replicating the same action because it would be subject to the same bylaws violation every single time it does it. So it has to go back and change its working methods as it looks at the impact of the declaration that says this as applied was against your bylaws. So it would be impractical to say that ICANN would just look at this as an as applied circumstance and not look at it more holistically. So that this might be part of the discussion we've been missing over the past couple of years, that we actually see the potential impacts of an IRP declaration as bringing about the change that Malcolm keeps, and others, not just Malcolm, of course, have been saying they want to see, right? What if ICANN is doing something that's so fundamentally wrong? If there's just a single point of challenge, doesn't that go to just a single one, or does it impact things more broadly? And from the ICANN perspective, we would say it impacts things more broadly. And so if people have a different understanding, I think that that's probably worth talking about to see how we could play out, because I think that that's where the stress testing is needed, not necessarily about individual examples, but what's the broader impact of a declaration that says, ICANN, something that you're doing today is really against your bylaws, and then talking about what that means for ICANN in the future, fixing that problem.
Okay. Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you. I think we need to get to the heart of what's meant here by as applied versus a facial challenge. And I tried to bring this out with these examples. So since we got the second one on the screen, let's just look at this and think what this means in those terms. Now, in this example, it is postulated that there's no dispute that Get Baked would be allowed to challenge how this policy, which sought to prohibit dangerous statements on the internet using the UDRP as an enforcement tool. It is open to Get Baked to challenge how that was applied to them by, for example, saying, our statements are not dangerous. Yeah. Our cakes are lovely and good for you. Yeah. That's not in dispute. But what Get Baked wants to do in this is something much stronger than that. They want to say, I don't want to argue about whether our statements are dangerous and have to litigate the medical facts around this. Our case is that ICANN, you've got no business telling me what I'm allowed to put on a website. It says so in terms in your bylaws that you've got no business doing that. And I want to make the case that is indeed what those bylaws mean before the IRP. That's not an as-applied challenge. That is a facial challenge. And that's why, Sam, I noticed in your email just before the meeting started, you talked about recent facts and so forth. But you'll notice that in neither of these scenarios, the facts are the recency of facts or any facts, really, it's all relevant. This is an entirely facial challenge. And maybe that speaks to what one of the things that Susan was referring to at the beginning about the possibility of cross purposes and maybe the opportunity for compromise. But these cases here, these scenarios are about saying, it's not how you applied this policy. You should not have such a policy. It's not about how you ran this program. You should not have this program. That's not an as-applied question. That's a facial challenge. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. And if I hear Sam correctly, she is arguing that that by virtue of the application, if you like, the original decision is back on the table in terms of being challenged.
I would actually like to hear, I've written some words into ICANN Legal's mouth in these scenarios, fictitious ICANN Legal, of course, not the real ICANN Legal. Yeah, this is a fictitious scenario. As to what ICANN Legal would argue under the circumstances where repose was written into the bylaws. I'd like to ask Sam, does she believe that I've represented that accurately, or would ICANN Legal not say the things that they're represented as saying in these scenarios under those circumstances?
We've got Chris and David with their hands up, but would you like to go first, or would you like Sam to respond to that first?
You're the chair.
let's do Chris and David first, and we can come back to Sam. Give her a bit of time to think about it.
Susan and Malcolm, I have a couple of questions, if it's all right, and I don't want to put anybody on the spot at all, but I'm struggling a little bit. And my first question is, so Malcolm, I understand the scenario completely. My first question is, let's assume that take the second one, because as you rightly say, it's on the screen. What do you envisage the outcome? Let's assume that the argument is made that you suggest that they want to make, which is perfectly fine. That argument is made and that they are successful. What do you envisage the practical outcome of that would be?
I think the outcome of that would be that if the IRP upheld that, they would issue a statement saying, yes, we agree, this policy is incompatible with the with the bylaws, with this section of the bylaws, and any policy of this nature is fundamentally inconsistent with this provision.
Right.
ICANN board, you must now go away under the bylaws and consider how to react to that. And following that, I would imagine that the ICANN board would be left with essentially no choice, no realistic choice, but to revoke the policy, which is the ultimate outcome that the claimant in this case is looking for.
Right. So a single body, a single organisation that believes that it is being harmed by a policy that the whole of the community has got together and made. The decision on whether that policy, because of it being, it's been accepted by everybody else, it's run perfectly well for however many years we've talked about, and a decision about whether or not that policy is ultra vires on a claim brought by one party is being left to be made by an independent review panel, not a court, but an independent review panel. And that's my, and I don't want to get into an argument about what the bylaws say and how you interpret the bylaws and how you should for the moment, but that's the fundamental problem I have with the example that you've given and going to the length that you have. To me, it cannot be right that an independent review panel can, there are enhanced community mechanisms in place if the community believes ICANN is acting outside the bylaws. There is legal action available in court if people believe the company is acting outside of its bylaws. But to have a situation where the community itself has set a policy with all the checks and balances that are in place and has by definition decided that policy is within the mission, because otherwise the GNSO wouldn't have set the policy in the first place, and that can then be tested 5 or 10 years down the line by one organization, and the decision is left with an independent review panel. To me, that's the problem.
Thank you, Chris. That's very helpful in clarifying it. I must say, for my part, I think then your dispute is not with me, but with the CCWG accountability that constructed the scheme and the process that was then went through to take that and implement it mechanism.
Dispute is our interpretation of what the bylaws were intended to achieve, or what the recommendations and the subsequent bylaws were intended to achieve. So the dispute is not that. The dispute is that I interpret them one way. I say my interpretation is built on my belief that that is what the community intended. And you quite fairly take an opposing view, which I'm fine with. I completely understand your view. But what I'm saying is we are at odds as to our interpretation of what was intended.
Thanks, Chris. So David has his hand up and so does Christina. So David first.
Thank you, Susan. So here's a question. Do I sound like I'm down a well still?
Yes. You're better, but somewhat.
I apologize. Anyway, I'll be quick. I just wanted to speak. I'll say that I believe I agree with Chris, but I'll speak to a point that Sam made, and that is ICANN can't simply keep, seriatim doing violation after violation. They'll have to address it. The reverse is true too. If an IRP rules in ICANN's favor, a bunch of people can bring the same claim, but the notion of precedent will be used, I think, to have the claims dismissed. The one thing I'd like to say about Malcolm's scenario, and again, I say it with trepidation because I haven't read it myself, but based on what Malcolm said, is when a UDRP is filed against the company Get Baked, they may be able to say they're not going to defend, they're going to go file an IRP and say the application of the UDRP to me, just the filing of a complaint against me, is a harm. And that's what I would like to challenge. That, so it still, to me, might be falling under the as-applied notion. I don't know how an IRP would deal with it, but I just want to say that they may still have a remedy in that case, but I haven't moved off the as-applied notion myself. So thank you very much.
Thanks, David and Christina.
Thanks very much. Chris, I certainly understand the point that you're making. And I think one of the concerns that I have in response, and I'm noting Susan's point in chat, kind of, is it a timing issue or is it a single entity issue? And as for the latter, I think the thing that I think we need, I would like us to be careful about from that perspective, is that I don't, it is not the case that every entity that is affected or will be affected by ICANN consensus policy participates in ICANN. It's just, you know, I think we can all agree on that. So I think taking the position that a consensus policy could never basically be challenged by an entity, a single entity, that if it didn't participate in the policy development process, and I may be oversimplifying and or misunderstanding your point, but I have some real concerns with that. I think that would get us into, I think that would be problematic. And I do think it's the as applied point. And this is where I was going indirectly with my question about deadlines for implementation, because in many cases, I do think it's going to be, at least as with regard to consensus policy, it may be that it's not until we actually see the implementation or potential implementation of it that the an entity that would otherwise have standing, potential claimant, believes that it's been harmed. Thanks.
Thanks, Christina. Scott.
Thanks, Scott Austin, for the record. I guess there's something about the approach, and I really appreciate Chris's comment, because it really sets up the two positions. But in an attempt to find some middle ground, I guess the question is whether there could be a way that the IRP could, for lack of a better term, blue pencil or excise that part which goes beyond the UDRP max may go beyond the bylaws, but yet there could still be some of the policy that would be saved. It seems to me that we may be setting ourselves up with a false dilemma of an all or nothing, that the entire policy would have to be deleted, excised, rather than just the new social and harmful activity that may pertain to this particular UDRP register, or the one who lost, respondent, I should say, that lost. And I wonder if that's a possibility of there being a way to thread the needle, navigate Scylla Charybdis, pick your metaphor.
It would be, Scott, but you've got to get into the IRP first. If you're time barred, then you don't have any of those options.
Well, then maybe I'm missing the point in terms of the time aspect. We're saying that only because of the 5 years or post 120 days that this would not apply. Is there something about the level of the damage here that would make it more equitable to allow them in? What am I missing?
Scott, so I'm not sure that you are missing. I think what we're really grappling with is just whether we have that that reposed time limit in there or not. If it's there, then the sort of scenario that Malcolm is positing, in the scenario, you know, as he expresses it, you know, that they never get to an IRP because they're time barred. If we don't have the repose, then they have, you know, the option to bring that challenge, and you know, it's for the panel to make, you know, whatever determination they think is appropriate. And indeed for the board to do whatever they then think is appropriate in response to the decision of the panel. But I'm not sure if that answered your query or not, really. But Chris has his hand up, so I'm going to go back to Chris.
Thank you, Susan. I just wanted to, it's a couple of things. So first of all, I want to say I don't imagine for one nanosecond that there's an easy solution to this, and I acknowledge completely that the questions that people are raising are very valid and important questions. On Christina's point on timing, which I completely get, I must admit that I had thought that maybe I've misunderstood, but I heard at the beginning of the conversation we're talking about, well, is there a, or she asked, is there a maximum time within which policy can be implemented, etc. I had anticipated that a claim would be the timing would run from when the policy itself became used, rather than it would run from the time that the decision was made that it should exist. So if the board said the policy is that everybody should paint their computers green, go away, implement it, and it took all 3 years to implement that, I had it in my head anticipated that until it was implemented, you wouldn't know what would happen, and that therefore your challenge would be running from that sort of a time. So that was in my mind from a timing point of view. But in respect to Scott's question, I think that's a good question. I don't have an answer for it, but perhaps Malcolm does. But I hope I've at least tried to address one part of what Christina raised.
Thanks, Chris. So Christina's made a suggestion that we sort of pause this discussion, having reached sort of some of an understanding of where we all are, and perhaps think about prong one briefly. It would certainly allow us to everyone to give more thought to these the scenarios that Malcolm suggested. And indeed, you know, we might usefully, if people have other scenarios from the counter perspective, you know, we could usefully share them in over the next week or so, before we pick this discussion back up. I'm not managing to follow the chat terribly well, so if people have been making really good points in the chat, they might want to make them on audio. Malcolm has his hand up, so I will go to Malcolm, and then before we do park this, I think, you know, Malcolm originally did have a question for Sam that he was hoping she would address in terms of whether his view of what ICANN Legal's perspective would be was a correct one. Now that might be unfair in putting Sam on the spot when she hasn't had much opportunity to give this detailed consideration, but I'll give Sam the opportunity to respond to that, or alternatively to suggest that we come back to that. But first, Malcolm, you've got your hand up.
Yes, thank you, and I'm quite happy for Sam to take that away and think about it and come back at another date. Where I put my hand up actually was to you just gave an invitation for others to come up with other scenarios. I'd like to invite you to sort of turn the pressure up on us a little to turn that invitation into a request. You know, I was asked to show what the harm I thought would be done by repose, come up with some concrete scenarios that show some concrete harm, and I've done so. I would now like to see the same thing for the other side of the argument. Yeah, what actually harm do you think would be done by having the rule in the way that I proposed that it be? Yeah, show us the harm in a concrete scenario in a similar fashion, what would be done. And we may from that be able to find some solutions. We may be able to find some other mitigations that could be put in place that would either reduce or remove those prospects of those possibilities of harm. But I don't know what they are yet. So can we turn that invitation up to a request? Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. I guess I thought I had made a request, but I'm obviously being much too polite. So yes, your way of putting it is much more appropriate. That is what we would like to see. That was obviously what we had been hoping we would see over the course of the last couple of weeks. But yes, please. You know, and they can be fanciful. I mean, Malcolm's is fanciful. And it's easy to criticize the particular scenario and, you know, and argue that that could never happen. But the point of these is to try to have some scenarios where we can, you know, where we can work through the issues, and they kind of have to be fanciful in order to be able to do that effectively. So yes, that is an action item for people, please. Sam.
Thanks, Susan. First, on the question about whether or not ICANN Legal would respond in the way that Malcolm posited with, that we might, you know, it would be very hard for us to come up with a definitive yes or no on that based on a hypothetical situation. You know, I did include some thoughts on that in my email that I sent, which was, you know, ICANN would never give a potential claimant permission to file an IRP. ICANN doesn't hold that power. ICANN would never direct a claimant as to what or what not they could file their IRP over. You know, ICANN in each situation, based on the facts, asserts the defenses that are or discussions that are available to it. ICANN would clearly test and ask the IRP panel to consider whether or not the claimant met all of the requirements for standing and bringing an IRP. And so those are things that ICANN would do. But the particulars of how ICANN would address those situations, I don't think that we could provide, you know, too much more detail on that.
Presumably, Sam, though, if ICANN Legal thought that a claimant was out of time, it would make that argument to the IRP, would it not?
Yes. Yes, it would. That goes into the entirety of, you know, reviewing to make sure that the IRP is being used within the bounds of the bylaws and, you know, and within the rules that have been set. I do think that one of the things that we need to consider as we're looking at trying to prove the negative that you know, are there situations where this would cause concerns, you know, well, I think, you know, from the ICANN org side, I know we have some examples and we'll revisit those. And I would imagine other people on the call have some ideas of things that they could consider if a decision that they relied on was overturned years later, how that might impact them. But I do think it's also important to realize that the IRP is not the only form of recourse that exists within the ICANN system. And when we get to something as fundamental as basing the idea that everyone within the ICANN system is essentially complicit in allowing an ultra vires policy or program to be done, that we have, and we would again expect to see the ICANN community acting through formal or create their own channels to challenge that action and not necessarily only having the IRP available to them. So that we don't require the ICANN community to go through an IRP in order to raise concerns or issues that they have about things. It's one formal channel. And so as people are looking at those examples, I think for both sides, I'm talking about the size of, you know, repose versus no repose. I think it's important to consider, are there other ways that we've seen the ICANN community come up against something, but not in a formal process? You know, are there other ways to achieve the result, which is to tell ICANN, look, you did something wrong. And it's not just about the fact that someone picked it up, you know, a few years later, but you know, the IRP is just one part of the accountability of the system. And I think we also have to look to the accountability of each of the actors in the system. So if someone thinks that we've really done something wrong, we don't have the experience in the ICANN community that they just sit back and wait until ICANN does something to further that wrong. They speak out. And so I think we have to look at this a bit from the realities of the ICANN system too.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. You know, I somewhat agree with what Malcolm said earlier in the chat, which is that basing you know, the idea of repose on the idea that, you know, somebody else should have acted, and therefore, if no action was taken, it's fine. I think that's not the case when it comes, you know, we're talking about a substantive issue, and I don't think it's an issue of being complicit or not. If an issue arises and someone recognizes that under that, in fact, there is a bylaws problem, a violation of the bylaws problem, and recognizes that, you know, somewhere down the road. And of course, the ICANN community is a malleable concept, in the sense that, you know, tomorrow's applicant might not be in the community today. And they may be the one who has the problem. And other people come and go. And there's also the fact of the matter that, you know, there's only a limited bandwidth to pay attention to all of the problems and successes of what we're doing. But in any case, you know, I think what's in terms of what other aspects of or other avenues there are, I think the other avenues, you know, are kind of fit for different purposes. And the question, I think, comes back to whether this is an avenue to challenge a policy that violates the bylaws, or is it an action, or, you know, allegedly, or is it an action to challenge a decision to enact a policy that violates the bylaws, allegedly? And some of the concern about unintended consequences, I think we could deal with in terms of, you know, the question of retroactivity. And in most decisions are not, you know, retroactive around, you know, these sorts of things. You know, it's they're forward looking. I think if we could clarify that, you know, that somebody can't, you can't go and say, well, now if we've decided this violated the bylaws, that every action that was taken over the last 8 years that was in compliance with this policy is now voided. I mean, there are situations where you have that, like a dirty cop. You know, you can void a conviction based on false testimony. But in most other cases, you know, you can't necessarily go after things retroactively. So I think that's one of the concerns that's been raised. And it's a valid concern, but I think it's one that needs to be dealt with. And the last point I'll make, and then I'll shut up, is that maybe all of us need to go back and look at kind of the policy recommendations and kind of the legislative history of how we got here, because that may help us all decide what it was we decided to do in the first place, whether we agree now with where we were at or not. And I may go back and look and find out that what we actually decided is not what I think should be the right thing, and that we would have to essentially begin a new process of changing the bylaws in order to accommodate what I or some of us now think is the right way to approach this. But in fact, what we decided is, you know, that this is basically a policy about decisions, and that decisions are, you know, temporal in time, as opposed to about policies which are, you know, continuous. Who knows? I don't know. Let's go back and look. If worst came to worst, we have to like get policy guidance or something. We might need to do that. But hopefully, if we all go back and look together, we might have there might be a clearer path than we know what each of us is positing. Because I think there are pros and cons to every argument here. It's not black and white. It's not like there's a truly right answer and a truly wrong answer based on kind of fundamental principles. It's unfortunately more nuanced than that. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Sam? Sorry, I've lost you, Sam. Was that an old hand?
Yeah, that was an old hand. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Scott.
Yeah, hi, Scott Austin for the record. I appreciate what Greg has said, but I want to get back to what Chris had said, because I think what I was trying to articulate before was, it's a beautiful fact pattern, Malcolm, and I've written law school exams, so I appreciate the time that it takes often to do that. The thing that I'm trying to articulate is, I'm not sure where this fact pattern goes with getting at the time issue
as much as the issue, as Chris has put it, of one person coming back and essentially using the IRP process as a appeal process for a lost UDRP case. And what we're trying to do, and that's, I think, where we're getting into a pretty deeply philosophical and nuanced discussion of the purposes of policy, and that being it's to discourage or encourage certain action. And, you know, my initial premise in confronting the time issue was, you know, and I've worked with legislatures before, and the use of statutes of repose was all about people's memories fading after a certain period of time. This doesn't seem to apply in this, in that context. And certainly there are other points, but that was one of the things that I had to get through. But we're dealing with something very different here. And it seems to me the facts could change very much as the policy could evolve over time. And it's much more of that issue. I'm just still trying to see, even in this scenario, where, when the case was brought or the time tie-in here is really affecting our decision on whether this should have been, this policy should be removed or not removed, because there's something in here that deals more with someone coming back to ICANN as ICANN and saying, hey, the UDRP, this doesn't work, we lost, and so we're just gonna say, throw the baby out with the bathwater. That is the way it appeals to me.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Chris.
Yeah, thank you. And Scott, I appreciate what you just said. If I understand the position correctly, I think that the argument against repose is simply that a party should not be prohibited from bringing an IRP simply because they weren't around at the time. If they are suffering because of it. Now, of course, I mean, one of the challenges with that is precisely the fact that you can create a circumstance where what you do creates the case. In other words, I will make sure that I operate in a way that brings me outside of this policy. It's very, very hard to reach, I think, very, very hard to reach a decision point on the principle based on examples, because examples are useful for explaining what you mean, but I'm not sure that they're useful for dealing with the principle. I completely understand that I may be interpreting the bylaws in a different way, or saying even if the bylaws are interpreted in a particular way, then I'm not sure that that's what was intended. But it seems to me that we built a mechanism, and I was there, so was Malcolm, and so was Greg, that had, you know, huge powers invested in the community to have the community step in the event that there was a problem. What I'm concerned about at the moment is that we are in danger of building a mechanism whereby a party way outside of what would normally be a reasonable period of time, in the sense of the policy exists, I'm aware, I've arrived in this business, and I walk in the door knowing what the rules are. So I may not have been aware of it when it was granted, but I've stepped into the business and I've stepped in knowing what the rules are. It seems to me that we're in danger of creating the ability for the community itself to be outgunned, outguessed, or overturned by a single IRP. By a single review panel. And I just don't believe that that's what was intended. It just doesn't make sense to me. And let me be clear, I'm more than happy to be wrong about this. Well, I'm not more than happy. I'm prepared, let's put it that way, to be wrong. But I just think that the examples are fine, but as from a principle level, it's where I struggle.
Thanks, Chris. So I put myself in the queue because I wanted to react to something that you'd said, and now I kind of want to react to two things, and then I can see Malcolm has his hand up, so I'll go to him after that. But I think the first part was I sort of wanted to react to your comment about this seems to be an argument about the party shouldn't be prohibited from an IRP because they weren't around at the time, and that their actions can create that scenario for them. I don't think that is what we're talking about here. And I'm not trying to argue here one way or the other in terms of the outcome, but what we're not talking about them not being around at the time, although they may not have been, but we're talking about the bylaws tells you when you're a claimant and what you have to be to qualify as a claimant. And they aren't a claimant because they're not damaged. And so it's not they're not around at the time, it's that they don't qualify to bring on IRP at the time. And so that's, I think, the difference to my mind that,
but that doesn't apply in Malcolm's example, though. But that doesn't apply in Malcolm. I'm sorry, I was referring to Malcolm's example.
Well, I think it does. Well, does it not? I mean, they're not.
So they were there at the time and they did nothing about it.
But they're not impacted until the policy is applied to them.
So I should consider the possibility. I mean, I the problem with that is that no one can legislate for the future. So how do you deal with that on that basis? If you can say that a business action I take in, I was involved in the decision making process, and in 5 years' time, I take a business decision that means I'm suddenly impacted by a decision that I was involved in, and therefore I can bring a claim. That can't be right, can it?
Well, I think that might be something that we need to explore. I think we talked about it a bit on the last call, where I said I was having problems with the idea that perhaps you weren't a registrar, and therefore, you know, you signed up to become a registrar knowing that the policy said a certain thing, and then you turn around and challenge it. I agree with you. I have a bit of a problem with that, but I do think, and I think Malcolm's scenario one perhaps is an easier one to look at, that, you know, they aren't a claimant because there's no, you know, there's nothing for them to bite on in the context of the bylaws until ICANN brings that project into their territory. And that's what I'm sensing we're trying to balance. Anyway, I'm going to shut up. I've got Malcolm's hand and Greg's, and then I think we have to wrap up.
Thank you, Susan. And yes, I know we focused very much on the second scenario, but the first one I think is clearer in that particular point. And it was intended in the way that you described it. So you did indeed read that right. I just wanted to respond to when Chris had said that we are in danger of building something that could have these terrible consequences of which he warns us. No, we're not. We didn't build this. This was built for us. This committee is here just to implement rules of procedure, not the whole structure. The structure is written. And what we are now discussing is whether or not the very fine and particular power that we've been given to create a deadline for filing, a deadline by which the papers must be filed, can properly be used to challenge what you think is a structure that you think might have this these dreadful consequences of overturning, you know, community positions. Well, I'm going to turn back on you, Chris, with greatest of respect, something that you've said many times in this context here. You said here that many times that these claimants may be in the wrong venue. I would respectfully put it to you that you are in the wrong venue here in trying to cure the problem that you are speaking of through the mechanism of the time for filing. That is not an appropriate way of dealing with that problem. The proper way of dealing with that problem is to actually challenge that the IRP can indeed do the things that it appears to be able to do. Trying to shut people out of it because you dislike the possibility of them being able to win that, using such a micro thing as the deadline for filing is really abusing the powers that we've been given here.
Thanks, Malcolm. And Greg, I think you're going to have the last word.
That's scary. Greg Shatton for the record. Briefly, I think, you know, there is, you know, a concern if the community thinks that they got this right and a particular claimant thinks that it was wrong. But ultimately, the test is whether something violates the bylaws or not. And I think that overall, while we do have the empowered community, if the community wishes to challenge a decision or a policy, you know, there's standing issues there potentially too, but they're, you know, much bigger standing issues that Susan went into, which is, you know, that no matter how much somebody thinks something is right or wrong, or violates the bylaws, they can't bring an IRP unless they have a harm that they can demonstrate to them, you know, themselves, that they're essentially, you can't just kind of, you know, bring a case, which I guess goes back to some of the discussion about declaratory judgment perhaps earlier, but that's more to the point of or an advisory opinion, but really goes to the question of whether, you know, we are limiting in many ways how a decision can be challenged, because we need the challenge to come from someone with a harm and not just someone with a theory. But the question is whether there's some reason why that harm comes too late to challenge a policy. And ultimately, you know, I think I'd agree with Malcolm, we need to look back to the IRP itself to see whether there is a reason to say that, you know, that a harm can exist without a remedy merely because of time. Thanks.
Thank you. And apologies, Scott, I can see your hands up. I was thinking that was an old one, but I will just...
It is an okay. Old hand, sorry.
Perfect. All right. So look, thanks everyone. I said Greg was going to have the last word, but I mean, obviously it's not the last word. There's clearly more for us to do. You know, circling back to the request, for other examples, and specifically examples that we can use from both perspectives. Well, we have the examples that Malcolm have provided of where he sees the harm come if we do put it in a repose. So let's have some for the harm if there isn't one that we can also consider. I think we do, you know, it's been interesting sort of listening to the debate. We've got, you know, we've got sort of Sam and ICANN org arguing that you know, this IRP is not the only process that you can use. You know, that one would have expected if ICANN is acting so far outside of its mission that you know, the community would have rebalanced. And that's a perfectly valid point, but at the same time, one could also say, well, in that case, what's the harm in building in this fail-safe, which will probably never apply, because in these terrible scenarios, someone else will already have challenged it. So, you know, there are two perspectives on all of this, and we're trying to find a middle ground. Perhaps there is no middle ground, but it may be that there is a middle ground of different types of dispute that perhaps need a slightly different treatment. And if we can try and explore that, I think that might be helpful. Otherwise, you know, we do have these, you know, very clear and diametrically opposed positions. I'd also would really like to understand further quite exactly what it is that Sam is arguing in terms of the implementation, in terms of, you know, in the scenarios in these stress tests, if it's the implementation as it applies to the particular, you know, proposed claimant that gives them their right of action, does that enable them to reopen the original decision, or is that reopening of the original decision time barred, which is how I've always interpreted this and clearly how Malcolm interprets it. But, you know, perhaps we're wrong, and I can legal views this in a completely different way. And maybe that is, you know, maybe we are all talking at cross purposes, but I'm not sure yet. So lots of homework. Let's if we can, try to keep exploring this on the email. It certainly would be preferable for us to keep the conversation going rather than sort of all pause for 2 weeks and then come back to it. But thanks, everyone. We're out of time now. So I will see you all in 2 weeks' time, hopefully. And I think that's all I need to do. Any other business? I didn't have any raised at the beginning. I forgot to ask. If anyone does have any, then speak quickly. Okay. I'm not hearing anyone. So we can wrap this up. And thanks very much. And Pamela, we can stop the recording.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, everyone.